Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter in Washington. Today is February 28, 1979, and this is my audio letter number 43. All across the United States, millions of Americans are growing weary of a long, harsh winter. Over large areas of the country, the winter storms this year have been abnormal and unpredictable. Time and again, America's industrial heartland in the Midwest has been paralyzed by unusually heavy snowstorms. Powerful rainstorms have battered California, which supplies a major share of America's food supply. The major population corridors of the Northeast have endured storm after storm, taxing energy supplies and human patience. In the Southwest and elsewhere, storms have caused losses of electrical power on an unprecedented scale, and even here in Washington, D.C., the biggest snowstorm in over 50 years has just taken place. For days, the nation's capital was brought to a standstill by 2 feet of snow, and we are still digging out. And strange weather patterns have struck also in Europe this winter. 4 weeks ago, on January 31, NATO ground forces gathered in Germany for their first winter maneuvers in 6 years. When they began, conditions appeared ideal. The ground was frozen solid to the depth of 5 inches, making a nice firm footing for NATO tanks and other vehicles. There was also a convenient amount of snow on the ground, a little less than a foot. This was enough to make the war game seem realistic without actually making things difficult. The NATO teams were divided up into mock invaders called the Orange Force and defenders called the Blue Force. At 1 minute after midnight, January 31, the Orange Force began its make-believe invasion. It was right on schedule, without the element of surprise that would exist in a real invasion. Even so, the attacking Orange Force soon outflanked the Blue defenders. And for the next 2 days, the Orange Force, representing the Warsaw Pact, rode southward across the West German landscape. Meanwhile, the so-called Blue Force, representing NATO defenders, were getting set to counterattack. On the morning of February the 2nd, the third day of the make-believe war, the Blue Force was almost ready to go. But then the unexpected happened. Suddenly the weather changed. Strong, warm winds blew up out of nowhere, and soon these were joined by rain. Within hours, the ideal maneuvering conditions vanished. The snow melted, swelling streams and causing local flooding, and the frost melted, causing the whole area to turn into a mud bog. Tanks churned and groaned as they sank into the mire. Meanwhile, NATO's alleged new wonder weapon against enemy tanks, the A-10 close-support aircraft, turned out to be absolutely useless. They were grounded by dense fog. Flooding caused a rush evacuation of a field hospital, and for 3 days NATO troops, tanks, and artillery sat stalled in a so-called administrative hold, quote unquote. Finally, NATO Commander General Alexander Haig flew over the scene by helicopter and then called off the whole thing. And so the NATO exercise, which had been named Certain Sentinel, ended on a very uncertain note. Meanwhile, 200 miles away in Czechoslovakia, Warsaw Pact maneuvers were underway too, and when the weather changed, they went on as if nothing had happened. It's almost as if the weather itself had turned against the United States and the NATO alliance, and, my friend, it has. Over a year ago in Audio Letter 29, I revealed that Russia had begun the operational deployment of hovering weapons platforms. These remarkable machines, which the Russians call Cosmospheres, are armed with charged particle beam weapons. When I recorded Audio Letter 29, 7 Cosmospheres were on station over the continental United States, and they were causing the famous air blasts, now called airquakes. These were the byproduct of weather modification experiments using their beam weapons in a defocused mode. 14 years ago, the late General Thomas Power, former commander of the United States Strategic Air Command, gave a public warning in advance about these hovering military craft. In Audio Letter 32, I review General Powers' efforts to warn America before it was too late. But he was ignored, and Russia developed these machines, while America did not. And today, they are on station over our missile bases, major dams, and cities, ready to pulverize targets on command. They are also manipulating the weather over the United States. And a squadron of Cosmospheres used the weather to turn NATO's so-called Certain Sentinel maneuvers into a farce. The purpose was a bloodless object lesson to the Western European members of NATO. The Kremlin is trying by every possible means to persuade Western Europe to stay out of the coming thermonuclear war between Russia and America. But most Americans still are blissfully unaware of the reason for much of this winter's unusual weather. All they know is that they are tired of winter and looking forward to the first signs of spring. And yet, my friends, if the new Bolsheviks who now control the American government have their way, the season of real trial and hardship is only beginning, not ending. Their intrigues are accelerating toward a climax, and as winter melts away, the world is heating up with the danger of war. 6 months ago, in Audio Letter 37, I revealed in detail the top secret plans of America's rulers to initiate nuclear war with Russia. For the first time in American history, it is now the master strategy of the United States to strike first in a major war. And in this same audio letter, I outlined the steps which were being planned to lead up to full-scale war with Russia. The strategy of the new Bolsheviks to launch an American nuclear first strike against Russia is already far advanced and moving fast. Many elements of the top-secret plan which I revealed last August have already become highly visible. First, the Camp David summit of last September 1978 set the plan in motion. The plan I had revealed was followed to the letter, and the so-called surprise peace accords were signed with big smiles by Carter, Begin, and Sadat on nationwide television. Likewise, the Bolshevik plan to throw the Roman Catholic Church into their own fight against Russia has been moving along right on track. Pope John Paul I, elected only the day before I recorded Audio Letter 37, quickly left the scene, and today the anti-Russian policies of the Vatican are becoming more visible by the day. More recently, the crucial importance of Iran and China in the first strike plan has caused them both to dominate the news. As planned 6 months ago, Iran has been made a source of concern to the American public, and China, whose western province of Sinkiang is essential to the American first strike strategy, forced the United States into full diplomatic recognition over 2 months ago. Now we are moving rapidly toward the stage of oil shortages and gas rationing as the crisis atmosphere intensifies prior to war. And exactly according to plan, Saudi Arabia is being painted more and more as a threat to peace by politicians and the controlled major media. My friends, springtime is always a time of unrest and possible war. It is the easiest time of the year to trigger violence. And as spring approaches, preparations are underway jointly by the United States and Israeli governments to trigger an incident that will cause war to erupt in the Middle East. The nuclear destruction of Saudi Arabia's oil fields is intended to follow soon afterward. In Eastern Europe, too, the coming of spring is accompanied by great danger this year. Last month I revealed the Bolshevik plan for the Pope's revolution, quote unquote, to erupt in Krakow, Poland, this May. The key to the plan is to be the visit to Poland in May by the actor Pope, the man who calls himself Pope John Paul II. And just 6 days ago, it was revealed that the Pope now plans to be in Poland May 13 through the 15th. For the reasons I revealed last month, my friends, it will be the beginning of the end for the West if the Pope's revolution does take place. That means the next 2 months or so could well determine the future course of human history. If that history is written according to the satanic Bolshevik plan, it will be written in our blood, and it will be a story of thermonuclear catastrophe, unparalleled destruction, tragedy, suffering, torment, all on a scale that is beyond human comprehension. And yet, my friends, I must remind you once again of something I pointed out in my very first talking tape, recorded over 4 years ago in October 1974. That was audio book number one, titled How to Protect Yourself During the Coming Depression and Third World War. The information I make public from my own intelligence concerns the plans of men. These human plans are not unchangeable. The men who make these plans like to play God, but they are not gods. Their plans do change. Their timetables do slip. They do make mistakes, and the unexpected does happen. During the past several weeks, my friends, the unexpected has happened. Dramatic events have taken place, hidden from the public, which will inevitably have profound effects on the course of events, both here and worldwide. My three topics for this month are topic number one, the mysterious disappearance of Dr. Henry Kissinger. Topic number two, the plundering of the Rockefeller family empire. And topic number three, our last chance to save Western civilization. Topic number one, last month, on the evening of January 26th, the life of Nelson Rockefeller suddenly came to an end. 5 days later, when I recorded audio letter 42, I was able to report that he had been murdered by a single expert shot to the head. Immediately, Rockefeller aides and spokesmen were put to work in a feverish effort to cover up what had happened. For the reasons I mentioned last month, Nelson's surviving brothers, David and Lawrence, felt that it would be too dangerous to have the public know he had been murdered. It would have raised too many questions, and so Rockefeller spokesmen spouted one set of lies after another for public consumption. Meanwhile, Nelson Rockefeller's body was cremated quickly to make sure that the multiplying public questions about his death did not lead to an autopsy. By the time I record audio letter 42 on January 31, key Rockefeller family spokesman Hugh Morrow had run through three versions of the circumstances surrounding Rockefeller's death, and each new version demolished what he had already said. About a week later, the third version began falling apart. News reports quoting unnamed sources within the Rockefeller family said that the person who had called the New York emergency number 911 for an ambulance was not Megan Marshak. Miss Marshak, Rockefeller's young aide, had been with him in his townhouse at the time of death. But the 911 call, it was now said, had been made by Miss Ponchita Pierce. Miss Pierce, a New York television personality, was said to be a friend and neighbor of Marshak. On Saturday night, February 10, Ponchita Pierce put an end to several days of questions and rumors by releasing a statement through her attorney. But her statement triggered new questions, as it ruined all previous statements by Rockefeller's spokesman about Rockefeller's death. In her statement, Ponchita Pierce said that Megan Marshak had called her between 10:50 and 11 p.m. on that evening of January 26. That ruined the official story of Rockefeller's spokesman to the effect that Rockefeller had suffered his heart attack, quote-unquote, at 11:15 p.m., and it revived the early questions to the effect, why all the delays between Rockefeller's alleged heart attack and a call for help? The Pierce statement added to the mystery in another way, too. She said that she got to Rockefeller's townhouse at about 11:15. Called the 911 emergency number to request an ambulance, and then left quickly to go back to her own apartment. The natural question is, why would anyone flee from the scene of a heart attack? Especially since, contrary to some reports, Ponchita Pierce had known Nelson Rockefeller for more than 10 years. Why didn't she stay to help, unless he was obviously beyond help? On the same day that Ponchita Pierce released her statement to the press, the New York Post quoted Stephen Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's second eldest son, as calling for clarification of the whole situation. And 2 days later, his son Stephen Jr., Nelson Rockefeller's 18-year-old grandson, reportedly said, quote, "We just want the truth. The issue is simply whether he could be alive now." Had he been a more practical man, thorough in his bodyguard protection, maybe this would not have happened, unquote. These words of Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, Stephen Jr., were dangerously close to the mark. Last month I explained how Nelson Rockefeller had been caught in a weak moment with his guard down and with his normal large contingent of bodyguards off duty. 2 days later, February 14, his father Stephen made a complete turnabout. He joined with his brother Rodman and sisters Ann and Mary in a joint statement aimed at cutting off the controversy. The statement said in part, quote, "Since we are convinced that nothing could be done to save Father, and that all the people who tried to help acted responsibly, we feel that it is wrong for us to take part in a continued debate over the details. Consequently, we do not intend to make any further public comment," unquote. But the circumstances surrounding the death of Nelson Rockefeller have an important bearing on the future of the United States, not just the future of the Rockefeller family. So the questions about those circumstances will not go away just by wishing it so. As a footnote to what I made public last month, I can now reveal the reason for the long delay between Rockefeller's shooting and the 11:16 p.m. call for an ambulance. Rockefeller did not die at 11:15 p.m., nor even at 10:15 p.m., as stated in the earliest news reports. The death actually took place between 9:30 and 10 p.m. After Megan Marshak recovered from her semi-state of shock following the shooting, she placed a call which still has not been made public. As a result of this call, a doctor quickly arrived who was prepared to handle the situation. The single gunshot wound in Rockefeller's forehead stopped bleeding in less than an hour. The doctor then filled the bullet hole with calamine lotion, which hardened. After cleaning off all the blood, the doctor's job was done. It would now be possible to remove the body by ambulance without the true cause of death being apparent at a glance to casual bystanders. The doctor's makeshift work on the scene did fool bystanders. But if you will look on page 39 of Look magazine for March 5, 1979, you will discover that the job was not quite perfect. The photo at the bottom of the page is of Nelson Rockefeller's body as it was being carried out of his townhouse on a stretcher. The picture is grainy and shows little detail. Even so, look closely. 1 to 2 inches above the bridge of the nose and slightly toward the left eyebrow, you will see a roughly circular dark area. That, my friends, is the hastily disguised bullet hole. The calamine lotion did not completely hide the discoloration and was not smoothed to perfection. Last month, I alerted my listeners to the fact that the man who stood to gain the most from Nelson Rockefeller's death was his protege of 25 years, Henry Kissinger. And Kissinger wasted no time in pushing ahead with his bid to fill Nelson Rockefeller's shoes in the inner family circle of the Rockefeller Empire. His campaign was already well underway on Friday, February 2, 1979. On that day, a memorial service for Nelson Rockefeller at the Riverside Church in New York was attended by well over 2,000 people from 71 nations. Eulogies were delivered by a daughter, Ann Rockefeller Roberts, by a son, Rodman C. Rockefeller, and by brother David Rockefeller, and by Henry Kissinger. It was Kissinger whose eulogy received all the attention from the controlled major media, and no wonder. The huge audience was hushed as Henry Kissinger made his way to the pulpit. Then, seemingly with tears in his eyes, Kissinger began to speak of Nelson Rockefeller. As his choking voice echoed through the great sanctuary of the Riverside Church, Kissinger referred to Rockefeller as friend, inspiration, teacher, and, quote, "my older brother," unquote. Kissinger's eulogy was a masterpiece and brought tears to the eyes of many. The final passage was about sitting with Nelson Rockefeller, quote, "on the veranda overlooking his beloved Hudson River," in the setting sun, unquote. And as the last words of the eulogy, Kissinger claimed that Rockefeller would occasionally say, quote, "Never forget that the most profound force in the world is love," unquote. With those final words echoing through the church, the man who had plotted the death of Nelson Rockefeller turned and slowly left the pulpit. What Kissinger did not suspect was that he had just said his final words in public. The following evening, Saturday, February the 3rd, Kissinger was reportedly in Seattle with the stated intention of seeing China's Deng Xiaoping. In fact, the Washington Post 2 days later reported that Kissinger saw Deng in Seattle on Sunday morning, February the 4th, but the Post was wrong about that. At about the same time that the Washington Post said Kissinger was in Seattle, he was actually at Dulles Airport outside Washington, D.C. Just past noon at 12:30 p.m. Washington time, February the 4th, Kissinger took off for London on the British Airways Concorde. Less than 11 hours later, Kissinger arrived at Chaumont in the Loire Valley, France, where it was the morning of February the 5th. From there, Kissinger flew nearly 200 miles west to Blois, France, in time to breakfast there. By late that evening of February the 5th, Henry Kissinger and his wife Nancy were in London. At approximately 11 p.m. London time, they took off for the United States in a private jet, and as they did so, they were subject to continuous surveillance. A network of 26 Russian Cosmospheres were on station at that time above the air lanes between America's East Coast and Europe. At 7:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, February the 5th, all contact with the jet carrying Henry and Nancy Kissinger was abruptly lost. The jet did not arrive at its destination, and Henry and Nancy Kissinger are nowhere to be found. Kissinger aides claim that he is on vacation, quote unquote. Meanwhile, articles keep being printed about Kissinger which keep his name before the public, but he himself has dropped out of sight. On February 15th, I stated publicly that Kissinger was missing on the Ray Bream talk show over radio station KABC Los Angeles. And on February 17, I appeared on the Bob Snyder talk show over radio station WING Tampa, Florida. On that program, I not only reported that Kissinger was missing, but stated that he had been so since February the 5th. I also gave Kissinger's itinerary immediately preceding his disappearance, that is, Washington to London, to France, to London again, and then missing. Now, there is already an attempt to head off public awareness that Kissinger is missing. His aides are now giving out a cover story which has already found its way into print. In the New York Daily News for February 26, just 2 days ago, the People section contained an item titled, "K Soothed Sorrow in Europe," unquote. It began, quote, "Where is Henry Kissinger hiding?" unquote. Saying that an unnamed Washington commentator suggested he was missing, the article says, quote, "Well, forget it all. The fact is, Henry and his wife Nancy left town shortly after the death of his close friend, Nelson Rockefeller, for a vacation from the news hounds. Henry left New York February the 4th, went to England, then France, back to London, and is now in Mexico," unquote. As I mentioned before, Kissinger left Washington on February 4, not New York, and his plane did not land in Mexico or anywhere else after leaving London on February the 5th. But the New York Daily News article says Kissinger is expected back next month, and just for good measure, a Kissinger aide is quoted as saying, "He is alive and well and may show up anywhere in the world because he's welcome anywhere," unquote. My friends, I can only say that it will be a miracle if the real Henry Kissinger is ever seen again. And speaking as a lawyer, I can tell you that only the real Henry Kissinger could bring legal action against me for what I have told you concerning his criminal activities against the life of Nelson Rockefeller. Henry Kissinger has vanished from the scene just as he was on the threshold of the ultimate grab for power that was his dream. But Kissinger conspired with others to bring about far more than the mere death of Nelson Rockefeller. And the startling events he helped to set in motion have continued despite his own mysterious disappearance.